Welcome to Leadershipadelic Season 3. My name is Sebastian Fouillade. Join us every week to discover how deep spiritual experiences have influenced people's leadership and how they build a better future for themselves, for their family, for their community, and at work. We cover a variety of topics from yoga to mindfulness, meditation, prayer, creativity, brain mapping, alternative medicines such as psychedelics, and so much more. By learning from these experiences, we can raise our understanding of leadership and build a better future together. Today, join us to meet the founder of Behold Retreats, Jonathan the Potter. Jonathan is a recovering strategy consultant, lover of big ideas, meditation, and the ocean. He grew up in Hawaii and now lives in Thailand on the small island of Koh Phangan. Jonathan shares his journey from his challenging times as a strategy consultant to his first ayahuasca experience, which was also very challenging but very transformative. This led him on a path to dive deeper into the world of plant medicine and consciousness, which eventually led to the creation of Behold Retreats. We cover many topics from challenging plant medicine experiences to the importance of proper screening in plant medicine retreats to honoring energy workers and so much more. We even make a small detour to discuss creativity, ChatGPT, and the age of wisdom. Check the show notes for info on Behold Retreats and to connect with Jonathan. Enjoy and see you on the other side. Jonathan, welcome to Leadershipadelic. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Sebastian. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I've been following you on LinkedIn and kind of looking at your work with Behold Retreat, and really wanted to get you on the show and learn more about who you are and what you've done. And where are you located right now?
I live in Koh Phangan in Thailand, which is a little island in the south, kind of quite filled with spiritual seekers, but also known for the full moon party, which is kind of the other energy, shall we say.
Wow, the full moon party. That brings back memories. We just did that in Peru in October. But it wasn't, I'm sure, it wasn't on the scale of what you experienced. Were you there? Do you do those full moon parties, or is it just one full moon party?
You know, I've never been myself. It's literally 20 minutes away, but it's a real rite of passage, probably of a different variety than you and I will speak of. It's, you know, it's the 18 to 24 year old British, American,
Australian.
And Australian. Yeah. And just they're really coming to see how much booze in a bucket they can drink within a 24 hour period, you know?
Okay. That was a different full moon party than the one I was thinking of. I was thinking of something more spiritual. I'm sure there's some spirituality there you can find. So Behold Retreats, let's start with that.
Yeah, you know, I think probably the right place to start is by sharing a little bit about my own first journey. So funny you mentioned Peru, because about 6 years ago, best friend and I decided to embark upon one of these ayahuasca retreats. And I went into that retreat, number one, as an atheist, number two, an overworked strategy consultant who wasn't treating himself or perhaps even those around him particularly well. And so I had a really hard time on retreat. You know, I passed out more times than I can count. I think I threw up about 150 times.
Oh.
And yeah, and I was hooked up to oxygen after each ceremony and found myself in, you know, special care at the end of each ceremony as well. So I had a really hard time. And yet I maintain it's by far the best thing that ever happened to me. And so through that experience and, you know, many experiences since and guiding friends in the right direction, et cetera, Behold is just kind of the natural evolution of identifying some of the things that I wished were there for me ahead of this experience, and also doing a little bit more in terms of screening and preparation, as well as integration. You know, from my first experience, I had access to all these new dimensions for the first time in my life, and I really didn't know how to make any sense of it. And, you know, at the way out of the retreat center, they kind of gave me a single sheet of paper and said, "Oh, you should probably try meditation." And while they were right, you know, I really felt strongly that I could have been held very differently than that first experience.
Wow. Okay. I'd love to kind of slow down on this journey that you took and go back to it and paint that picture and the learnings you had along the way. Like you mentioned you were a recovering strategy consultant. I don't know if you mentioned that now, but you mentioned in our previous conversation. So how were things before the retreat? What led you to that retreat in the first place?
Yeah. You know, it's a funny and humbling story because I come from quite alternative hippie parents, grew up mostly in Hawaii, you know, with plenty of potlucks and dancing circles and singing circles. And of course, I just detested everything to do with
like my
all
kids.
Of that. Yeah, there you go. And I went entirely the other way. I went, you know, straight into computer science to study. I went into the corporate world. I was very highly competitive, very driven to succeed. And so when I entered management consulting, you know, as you know, it's an environment much like corporate, much like tech, that really fosters or allows the competitive spirit to shine. And so, you know, it's all about the next client, the next project, the next promotion. And so I was, you know, in consulting, I was 5 years in Hong Kong and highly driven to succeed and, you know, thought I had all the answers and was doing pretty well for myself, climbing the ladder. And after 5 years of that and, you know, pretty unhealthy expat lifestyle, which is incredibly normalized in Hong Kong, drinking a lot, out a lot, you know, working very hard, 12 to 16 hours a day commonly. And at the end of that, I just remember reaching a day, an evening, looking myself in the mirror going, I don't know what the answers in life are, but this isn't it. Like, I just don't know what's next. I don't know what's coming. And so in that moment, decided to take a year off. And so in that moment, it was like, yes, I want to go travel, backpack around South America, start in Patagonia and work my way north. And when I mentioned to my buddy that I was going to travel in Peru, he said, oh, let me come and join you. I'll join you for your time in Peru and we'll go do one of these ayahuasca retreats. Now, I hadn't previously done any substances of this nature. Yeah. And from what I had seen in my friends' groups growing up in Hawaii, there was a lot of darkness around all substances, broadly speaking. Yeah. And so there's lots of nightmare stories to do with psychedelics through my childhood and adolescence. And so, you know, I was deeply cautious, but once I read a little bit about it, there wasn't much online like there is now. It's just an overwhelming amount of information. I came to recognize that, yes, you know, the soul was calling. And so we signed up for that first retreat in the Sacred Valley and the rest is history.
Wow. So when you signed up for it, you mentioned screening before. How was that process to get into the retreat? Like, was it, hey, you signed up, give us some money and you're welcome, talk to one guy and you know you're good? Or like, was there more of a thorough process?
Yeah, you know, I think in fairness to them, it was a thorough process. I have just been historically a rule breaker. there's a rebel deep within and so, you know, for sure, they articulated and listed the requirements that were to be adhered by. It's just that it was just one big long wall of text that was really overbearing in its nature. And then we had to fill out a few forms online. And then we did some, you know, very quick validation against that once we arrived upon retreat. Coincidentally, one of my best friends, and I didn't know this at the time, another one of my best friends had been to the same retreat center 3 months prior. And he also had a very difficult experience, pretty much full psychotic break, in fact. Wow. Was actually pumped full of the antipsychotics, which some retreat centers carry, which is, you know, not a easy journey, shall we say. And, but he also wasn't screened for, genetic predisposition to bipolar, which he had. And so, yeah, very, very difficult experience that he had as well. And so we only discovered this about four and a half years later, that we were actually within a short window at the same retreat centers having very difficult experiences.
Wow. So, as you went through this experience, I mean, it almost felt like it was a a rebirth in a way. I mean, you were challenged on I don't know, life support. And I picture you on life support after every ceremony and throwing up like 100 times. And I was like, wow, like can you give some highlights on some of the breakthroughs that you had through this experience?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the first ceremony, it's difficult for me to point at something positive, deeply traumatizing. I now recognize also that, you know, these are experiences that are subjective in their nature. And so to have the cosmology or the energies of a different way of seeing things pushed through your essence, pushed through your being, may not always be in the highest healing interests of an individual. And certainly I wasn't ready for that. And so the first night was multidimensional terror. Oh, wow. I didn't know what was up, what was down. I would say actually that my ceremony started, my first visions were incredible. I just had, you know, a multicolored Buddha just make itself known directly in front of me. And it was just full fractals, full colors, full just beauty. Wow. And then within the space of probably 5 minutes, everything intensified. I now recognize also that my brain was trying to reconnect with deeply repressed childhood trauma that I was not aware of. And so I think a very fundamental part of why I had such a difficult experience is I just had no tools to work with the medicine. Yeah. I didn't know how to ground myself. I didn't know that breathing was important. And if someone had just honestly told me to keep breathing, I think I would have had quite a different experience actually. And so the brain was trying to reconnect with this, you know, region, this memory of this 4-year-old boy who went through a truly horrific experience that I was oblivious to and, of course, was manifesting in many aspects of my character at the time. And, you know, at the end of the last ceremony, in fact, I had seen this little boy, not only in my mind's eye in the last ceremony, but actually there physically in the maloka, in the ceremonial space. And just at the very end of that last ceremony, I had the kind of insight to ask, well, why have I kept seeing this little boy? And in that moment, there was one of those Mario question boxes arose in my consciousness. And I was like, okay, well, what's in the question box? And really the message in that moment was, you're not yet ready to see what's in the box. And so in that moment, again, I stood up and I walked out of the tent, and that was the end of my ceremony. So I wasn't actually able to reconnect or to surface or release that deep childhood trauma in that first retreat. But I did get a lot of insights. I did get a lot of breakthroughs, not so much in that first ceremony, but in those that followed. And I had some really beautiful experiences to do with my parents in particular, showing all of the most potent emotions on their faces. So my mom, full of pride, full of joy, full of shame, full of guilt, full of fear. And then on individual instances throughout my life, how I had very directly caused those emotions within my mother. And so I was able as a third party to watch myself in how I was affecting others. And for me, that was a deeply profound experience. Then I had a repeat of that with my father, my stepfather, again, moment by moment through life. And it was just like, oh, wow. Okay. So just to recognize that what we have as beings, as creators, is this ability to qualify energy, and that we can use this life force to bring forth beauty and love and care and empathy and compassion, or we can bring forth this energy to do not such beautiful things and the effect that that has upon other people. And so for me, that was a very deeply humbling experience. I also had another experience where, you know, working in the management consulting environment, I used to externalize blame for quite a bit, you know, like, oh, he doesn't get it, or she doesn't get it, or they don't get it. And I had this experience where it was just showing me how the only thing that is limiting you is you. And it was like, it was this very kind of, you know, these experiences, they're like so cellular, so embodied, such vertical understanding. It's just so felt. And in that moment, I was like, yeah, yeah, that's amazing. And then there was like, you know, the mind came in for a moment and it was like, yeah, but it's not 100%. It's like, it's mostly me, but it's not 100% me. And it came back just 10 times as strong. Just, it's like, no, it's all you. And it was just like, is the most empowering and humbling moment at the same time, that it was just like, oh wow, okay, got it. And so yeah, I did get a lot out of the retreat. You know, for me, it helped me reorient my mind to its correct place in the hierarchy of self. And before that, my mind was the top of myself. And that was, yeah, I mean, as you may know from your own journey, that's a painful place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It totally is. And then there's a lot about surrendering as well that we discover through those journeys and letting go, learning to let go some of the material things, and even like relationships we've been clinging onto, I think, and the self clings onto that. How did you take those insights? So when you came back from Peru, you got hit with 100 purge buckets and oxygen and all that. And you're coming back from Peru, you have those insights. How do you take that forward? How did you take that forward?
I didn't do a great job, I'll be honest. I say to people pretty openly that I'm pretty much reverted exactly back to who I was before. and it did take me, I would say, probably a bit over a year before some forces began to triangulate in my life. And indeed, that piece of paper that they had given me on the way out my door of the retreat was correct, which was, I need to go to a meditation retreat. And so I went to a 10-day silent Vipassana meditation just near the Cambodian border in Thailand. And for me, having had opened the door with ayahuasca, this meditation retreat really brought everything down and in a really deep and meaningful way. And I think, you know, meditation and plant medicine taken to their potential are just, you know, peas in a pod. They're so symbiotic in their nature. And so, yeah, that really was the beginning of a serious meditation practice for me. Before, I was spending a lot of my time in taxis actually for my work in Bangkok at the time. And so, I was meditating all the time that I was spending in taxis. So I was already meditating, you know, probably a couple hours a day, but this was just, you know, 14 hours a day of, you know, you're in the hall at 4:30 a.m. and you finish around 9, generally speaking. So pretty full days of meditation, and also a very painful experience, but also to be able to just sit with pain and watch the mind do what it does and allow experience to unfold naturally was, to me, equally profound to the ayahuasca retreat in terms of the experience itself. But in this case, I believe I was able to take a lot more away from it. But I also lend a lot of that to the openings that I was privy to through the ayahuasca retreat.
Wow. So in hindsight, what do you think you could have done different, like to prepare for the retreat, to set yourselves up for a better experience? Where do you think you could have improved that?
One of the points that I seek to make to a lot of our guests is the extent to which you're driven to succeed in the corporate world or in your professional world probably relates to some degree, if not to a very large degree, to childhood trauma and the belief that you don't feel good enough. And so there's an emotional disconnect. There's a disconnect from our internal validation system, which requires that we seek external gratification. And so those like myself who have gone through quite significant childhood trauma, and I think all of us have gone through significant childhood trauma, it's just to what degree, you know, the ones who have gone through major trauma are going to be more driven. And so I think, you know, this is a dynamic that we see play out in the world, such that actually the world leaders or those who are at the top of organizations are often the most traumatized people. And so I say to people, you know, if you are highly driven to succeed as I was, then you may take this into consideration. And so I share that to come back to, okay, what would we help, what do we do to help people prepare? So number one, I think, understanding to what degree they are connected to their emotions. And then helping, you know, using the mind, whether it's the letting go process from Dr. David Hawkins or breath work or, you know, different types of somatic experiencing. There's lots of tools that are out there, you know, different things resonate with different people, different coaches, different therapists like to work with different tools, but to actually begin to work with this. Cause for me, in the ceremony, there was this amplification in the body and an amplification in the mind that I had no preparedness for. I just never experienced anything of that nature. And so to be able to work with our own thoughts and to work with our own emotions pre-retreat and begin to release some of these feelings and get in that habit of like, you know, and like, okay, I'm releasing fear. I'm releasing anger. I'm releasing these different, it makes such a difference so that then we have, you know, some basis for understanding of our nervous system and what can happen in the mind, body, heart, and spirit ahead of jumping in and amplifying with a powerful medicine such as, you know, ayahuasca or 5-MeO.
Yeah, that preparation is key. And commitment prior to the ceremonies to integration as well. Having that commitment as well. It makes a huge difference. And sometimes I feel bad for people who go there unprepared because it's like, you know, you're kind of not throwing money away because, you know, the medicine shows you what you need to see. And sometimes it's a little rougher than it needs to be. And you could be having a more effective experience if you really prepared better. I mean, I've had guests who really didn't follow diet or really had, you know, they were drinking or doing hard drugs all the way until the ceremony. Not guests in our retreat, but guests on the show who share that. And they got messages and hard lessons from the medicine that changed their lives. But at the same time, you know, if you can prepare, if you can, you know, do things like breath work, like you're talking about, or being able to, you know, just work with your thoughts and the breath work for me is key. It always goes back to that. And so it's a big deal to add that before. And I think a lot of retreat center say they're doing it. They provide videos because they want to scale the process. But the thing is people, you gotta handhold them at the same time. You really gotta care and be there for them in that preparation process. You can't, in my mind, you can't just show up at the retreat and say, okay, now let's get to work. Have you watched the videos? Oh, all good. I'm assuming that's not what you do. And if so, I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, I I love that. It's funny actually, because it's funny. It's very funny because we had actually thought about doing a few videos. we haven't done any yet, but we do spend time with each of our guests on a one-to-one basis pre and post retreat, even if they don't do any coaching or therapy with us, because I just think everyone's in a different spot, you know? And so when people say, okay, what, how do I, you know, even friends come to me, they call me up, they go, okay, I'm doing a retreat, you know, how do I prepare? And I always say the same things, which is think of this energetically. You know, if you think of mind, body, heart, and spirit, and what you're doing every day in order to demonstrate self-love to yourself. Think about who that future version of yourself really is and how it is that person is going to behave and be in this world. And so I think the great, you know, to your point around preparation, the more that we intentionally prepare all aspects of ourself and anchor that future version of ourselves in our own consciousness, then the magic really starts to happen, because that's the, I would say, reciprocation. You know, the more that we energetically invest in the in work of this nature is the more that the universe responds to that. And so, you know, even for me, I don't do any medicine anymore. I received the message that I had enough. But even throughout my journeys, you know, I had many friends who were facilitators and healers and say, oh no, you know, don't worry about this. I always, you know, don't have to pay me anything. And I always paid as much as I could, to be honest with you, because I always felt that this is such a deep energetic commitment that if it's not abundant for the person who's holding space, and if it's not seriously desired from me, and that takes an energetic form, which is that commitment that to that future self, that it's just not being taken with the same seriousness as should be.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think people don't realize how much work on the part of the facilitator and healers goes into preparing for a ceremony, preparing for a retreat, running the ceremonies, and then supporting people afterwards through their integration. Not everybody does that, but if you're following your journeyers through the entire experience, that's a huge commitment. And it's a lot of time, and it's a lot of care and love. And it takes a lot out of people as well.
It does. You know, one of the things I deeply care about, like really care about, just by virtue of my own experience and the variability of quality of experience that is out there, is to help people be discerning. So to help them find good options, even if it's not with us. You know, like you said, I think you said this, I can't remember if it was on the call or just before, but
just before.
Yeah, but I really liked what you said, which is that there's the right experience is there for everyone. And I hold that to be true. And, you know, some people will resonate and gravitate in one direction, and other people will gravitate in another direction. And, you know, there's a lot of negativity and judgment around ketamine clinics, but it's like, look, some people do want something that's convenient in Midtown and isn't going to blow out their whole day and is a toe in the water because they're carrying a lot of fear. And that's great. That's amazing. That's beautiful. And so, you know, I think it's, you know, as you say, I think what's important is to really honor the depth of the work that is being done by those who hold the space and are facilitating and doing healing work. Because, you know, I encourage people in their consideration, I encourage them to go look at the eyes of the facilitators and the healers that are sitting on the websites, because that tells you a lot. And there's a lot of people that are hunched over with, it's not exactly quite clear what's exactly going on in their eyes. And a lot of these people are overworked, and they have been for 3 months. They have been 6 months at one retreat center doing groups of 25 people for a month. And it's just like, oh my goodness, that is not the ordering of consciousness that we're looking for. It's not the energetic management that we know to be important within these spaces.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, there's just so many variables that go into crafting a retreat, a journey, an experience. I mean, we could go on for hours, but like overworked healers, like that's a big deal. Also, you know, then there's simple things like, how is the room organized? Where the restrooms are? Like, there's so many things that go into like building that retreat that I think I would recommend people is like, spend your time, you know, like if you're traveling somewhere to do a retreat, you're spending enough money to spend the time and have a conversation with the people there.
100%. Like, well, there's no book now button with, you know, the green arrows pointing at it on our websites. Like, we speak to each and every one of our guests before we extend an invitation to them. And, you know, it's, you know, what one of the things I also say to people is, you can see that they're all 5-star experiences. If you go to any aggregator website, it's just everything's 5-star. And so that tells us a couple of things, right? Which is, number one, people are having profound experiences. Great, amazing, fantastic. And number two, most of us have no ability to discern quality. And the variability that's out there, you and I know, is so great.
Yeah, I think after you've experienced a few different retreats on your own, you develop that taste, or that the ability to discern is like, oh yeah, I like what they did here. I didn't like what they did there. They could have done better here and there. I mean, I used to teach yoga, so it was the same thing. When I took a yoga class, there were teachers where I was like, okay, great flow, great breath, great alignment, great voice, and you know, great entrance. And, you know, there's every single steps on how the space is held, whether it's yoga or the ceremony room. And a lot of people skip on that. And you mentioned the big groups of people, of 20 people. You know, look at the ratio of facilitators to people.
Yeah.
You know, like we try to do like maximum of like, you know, like three guests for one facilitator. Because, you know, like some of those places, they'll get like 21 people. And you're like, there isn't enough facilitators to deal with everything there, or you'll end up in a room that's weirdly shaped and you're like, what the heck is happening energetically? And so you got to do your homework. I'm so glad to hear you. So what does Behold Retreat do exactly? Like, do you partner with retreat centers around the world, or do you run your own retreats with your own staff? How does it work exactly based on your learnings and experience? How did you implement that?
Yeah, so foremost, what I would say we do is we choose our facilitators and healers, not just on a rational basis, looking for tons of experience. There's just no replacement, particularly these days, actually, because I'm getting a lot more accounts of very intense energies coming into ceremony in ways that even people with decades of experience haven't experienced before, which is in of itself notable and interesting in relation to the future of this work. So that's one. Then there's the spiritual aspect, or the energetic aspect. We're looking for people who carry a high vibration themselves. So they are, they have done enough of their own inner work that they've embodied a very high vibration on a sustainable basis. It's not that they've gone up and seen the light and come back down and still living in negativity and judgment and scarcity and broken relationships and a messy house and the world should be this way. Those are not the people we're looking for. We have in essence, two different models. So there are two retreat centers that we partner with on a longer term basis because we really know, love, and trust them. And then we organize also, in addition to that, our own retreats. Our group size, you know, like you said, also tends to be pretty small, a lot of facilitators and healers on hand. General group size for us is between 5 to 8. We're just testing a retreat with a slightly larger group of 14. And that's just to hit a better price point because, you know, when you've got 3 or 4 people in ceremony, you've got high-end accommodation, you've got, you know, the unwavering love and support 24/7 of people who are doing good work at a high level. You've got chefs, you've got cleaners, you've got lounge, you know, you've got, you know the deal.
It's, it adds up quickly, but you want quality too.
You want quality. So because of small group size, we pay our healers well, and also we want them to live in alignment with their best life. And that does not mean 6 months of four week long retreats per month. That's not it. And so it's probably 2, or maybe in some cases 3, at a maximum for a duration, not 6 months, because they'll be done, by then. And so really making sure that we are paying our people well. We don't accept, with a few very minor exceptions, we don't actually allow volunteers on retreat, which is also a departure, from the norm. And that's just because we want to honor the work that is being done. And it is, as you know, it's work. As a result of that, you know, we are a bit more pricey than the norm, out there, but we stand by that. And, you know, I think you and I both are people that are of the orientation that believe that we're in the midst of this big transition from our investments in the outer world to now understanding that our consciousness is the only thing that's leaving us with us from this dimension of reality. And so from my perspective, you know, I drive like a $100 moped around. I don't have fancy very much. This is a rental house in, you know, small island in Thailand. I believe the only rational investment is into our essence, into our being, into our spirit. And I think we're just the beginning of seeing that that dial switch. And when it does, you know, we as facilitators and healers and those who are in service need to be ready for what is going to be a pretty big flood.
Yeah. You mentioned, I think that was in the form you filled out, but the need for people to do their spiritual work, this was probably the biggest thing we can do to better our world. And I mean, that's what this podcast is about, looking at the intersection of spirituality and leadership. How do you, you know, like learn from people's spiritual experiences to actually raise and elevate that leadership and build a better world for you, for a community, for where you work. And it's huge. At the same time, it's like all the people interviewed on the show learning from their experiences and where they've been, those what I call narrative shattering, whether it's like breath work, near-death experience, or psychedelics, and how that's helped them see the power of our consciousness and the importance of... You know, like people say, you know, that the ego is all bad. I think, I don't know if it was Ram Dass who said he learned to be friend with his ego. But, you know, it's like learning how to rise above all the duality, above all the division that we're experiencing right now. Everything is based on promoting the division and dividing us. And it's all connected. It sounds cheesy, but it is. And you feel it and you know it. So I'll get off my soapbox now.
I love it.
I'm going to switch gear here. You brought up ChatGPT just on LinkedIn. I love what you said about it. And I was wondering if you could actually talk about that a little bit, because it's such a great topic right now.
It is, you know, it's wow, we're going to live through some interesting times. What I see is this digital trash extravaganza just unfolding, right? You've got these tens of millions of eager, young, ambitious entrepreneurs who are being fed narratives about how to get rich and how to use this onslaught of tools that are making themselves available in the digital world. There's never been a better time to make a business. And that's more true every day than it was the day before, because we're just living through this, not just, you know, digital trash extravaganza, but also a creativity explosion. Not just in the technical sense, but also in the sense that I think technology ultimately will allow us more freedom to be truly creative. But then coming back to ChatGPT, yeah, what I mentioned, I really hold to be true. And like, so everyone's super excited about this capability that we can use to, you know, parse the entirety of the internet, basically, and to bring back some wisdom of knowledge in the tone of Gandalf. Why not? And so everyone's just finding a million and one ways to use this new capability in new and fun and interesting ways. And I think there's great beauty in hilarity in that. But at the same time, it's just demonstrating how information, how knowledge, how data is a bygone era. It's done. It's finished. And now we've entered the age of wisdom, which is embodied and which is personal. It's not objective in its nature. It's subjective in its nature.
I would add it's connected as well.
It's connected.
Because what you lose and a lot of the things that I'm seeing, whether it's like with the mid journey or stable diffusion, which create artwork based on the one line prompt, or ChatGPT, which will rewrite my summary of the retreat and add 60 guests instead of five and do all kinds of things. And we're losing that connection to the creator. We're losing that connection to the person that, you know, put each breath in their brush strokes. And for them, it was a journey to create that painting. For them, it was a journey to like create that story. And it's sad. And like but at the same time, we're enabling people to have immediate gratification. They're basically, which, you know, it started with, I don't know, a long time ago, probably with fire. But you know, Amazon one click ordering and you get your package tomorrow. And, you know, now you get your artwork, the perfect artwork. And then soon you'll get VR where you'll get that perfect world where you can basically just live into. I talk with my kids about it, and I'm like, you know, there's people in the world that just consume. And then there's people who actually connected to creativity, and that's a big part of our humanity. And if you take that away, eventually, you know, you've seen Wall-E, but eventually, you know, like we're going to devolve into, you know, just immediate gratification all the time. And some people argue, well, I'm very creative with my prompts and everything. I'm like, sure you are, and it requires a lot of work to learn how to use ChatGPT and Midjourney, and kudos to you, but like go take a paintbrush and you know, see how that feels. I could go on, but I use these tools too because I don't want to demonize them. I think every time you demonize something, you're also kind of feeding into like the dualism, and it's splitting things. And so I have a friend who's a creative writer, and he teaches class on creative writing. And he was like, my students, like, they're going to use ChatGPT to write their papers. Like, what do I do? And my district doesn't know what to do. My IT guy doesn't know what to do. I'm like, just lean into it. Like, see maybe how you can, I don't know, have ChatGPT write a bunch of haikus, and then your students write a bunch of haikus, and then you mix them up together and you try to have them use their brain to, you know, tell the difference, which ones have the wisdom like you're talking about and which ones are just pure knowledge. And, you know, or like learn new ways to write with ChatGPT, but like learn from it. Don't use it for pure gratification. So I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to share it, but it was going to be a post that was too long because I wanted to add my thoughts. I was like, oh, no way. We'll just talk about that on the podcast.
Yeah, I love what you've said there. And I think it's so true. I think, you know, it's almost like it's out of the box now with a lot of these capabilities. And so they just need to hit their extremity. You know, one of the things that I see is that the way that the world is structured at the moment, people are trying to outsource as much of their life as possible. They're trying to turn life into a transaction, right? You go, your babysitter is over here, and your this, and your, you know, your get your meals delivered, and you get your house clean, that you get all of these different aspects of what is life. We're trying to, like, you know, get leverage in relationships so that we can do this one thing that's going to make us a bunch of money. And then I think, you know, we're going to come full circle. We're going to realize what we wanted was just life itself. We wanted to be in the garden and get our hands dirty. We wanted to spend time with our kids. We wanted to cook a really nice meal together. And we wanted to, you know, argue about who's going to hang up the laundry. And like, that's what life is. It's not escape. We're trying to escape from life, and we'll come for full circle on that. I really believe it.
Yeah. So well said. you know, it's like one of the big lessons you get from psychedelics is like, hey, heaven is already here. Like, you know, we're already living in it. Now, what we've done with the world around it, like, you know, it's our doing, but like, it's also a matter of like how you're looking at it. And you actually brought this up also in, I loved how you said it in the form you filled out before, which is the divine, oh, and I can't even see it because there's so much on my screen, the divine order. I think you called it the divine order. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I think we through our lives, we tend to identify with the gap. And what I mean by that is that most people have the sense that like things will be okay when, as opposed to things being okay now. So we have this negative orientation that's so deep. And I still catch myself with it, even though I've worked on it incredibly long and hard, I still catch myself in it. And so we don't acknowledge the journey that we're on. We don't, you know, love ourselves and thank ourselves for all the learnings and all the lessons and all the growth and all the experiences, and all of the karmic lessons and all of those sorts of things. We tend to be like, A, B, C needs to happen, and then everything's going to be okay. And then we get to age 95 and we pass away and we recognize that we've lived our entire life thinking that everything is going to be okay when. And that's the tragedy. And there is, and I truly, you know, through medicine experiences and now try to embody each day, like you said, it's all here now. And it's all in divine order. And so all of the tensions, all of the transitions, all of the changes and energy that we're going to live through, it's all part of this much larger plan. And we've got our little part to play. And so, you know, our role is to try to embody this understanding that it's all okay. And even if you fall off your bike and, you know, scrape yourself, it's all okay. It's like, okay, what is this pain on my elbow trying to tell me? And what is the lesson? And it's just all part of what is. And so, you know, not separating ourselves from reality, because that's what's happening is when we are jumping into some future version. And I'm not saying that, you know, visioning and manifestation is not good. It's great. It's amazing. But like, to drive a wedge between us and what is, and to want what is to be different, is a very painful place to be. So I love what you said about, you know, embracing ChatGPT and just leaning into it and being like finding its creative uses is a really beautiful use case. I really like that. You know, it's powerful because we have to work with what is rather than trying to deny it or jump to something different.
Yeah, I mean, I can already see it. So, you know, you've heard about the investments Microsoft is making in OpenAI, and I expect them to integrate ChatGPT with Microsoft Word and actually lean into it, because if it's not going to replace Word, it's not going to replace a lot of things, but they already have an editor in Word, for example, that tells you, hey, you know, here's how you could tweak your text this way and that way. So the, I can see opportunities to kind of go beyond, you know, what the scenarios we're talking about today. And I'm excited to see what's coming, but at the same time, cautious. I want to switch to another thing, parents. And you talked about your parents earlier. And something you said, we choose our parents to support our soul's evolution. And I was like, wow, this is beautiful. If I look at life this way, my kids are certainly, helping my soul's, the evolution of my soul and vice versa, though that's kind of ego based. I think maybe they're teaching me more than maybe sometimes I think I'm teaching them. But like, how did you have that breakthrough to look at things this way for parenting?
Yeah. You know, it's, on this island, it's an island full of seekers, spiritual seekers. And there's great beauty in that, but they're all bouncing off each other pretty quickly and pretty unceremoniously to a large degree. And there's a lot of shock that's happening as a result of that. You know, younger people, 20, 25 to 35, 40 on average, right? And they're trying every spiritual modality through tantra, through psychedelics, through yoga, through hardcore meditation practices. You know, family constellations through, there's so many people on this island who see the world through this lens of, what's this framework that people are using, human design, the list, you know, there's obviously, this is a place of Buddhism. The list is, I'm just like, wow, there's so many people trying so many different things here. And, I live with my mom, and I said to my friend, how many of you tried living with your mom? And it just came to me that, like, you know, I, as I understand it, like the spark that's created in the moment of conception is really, it bears deep significance in relation to, the selection process. And so I truly believe that we choose all of our friendships, relationships, parents, etc., by virtue of something at a very deep soul level that can be reconciled. If, even if I'm to make a new friend here, you know, on the island, by virtue of the magnetism that exists between us, there is something deep that is going to arise over time. And so the question is, to what degree we are committing to do the work that's in relation. Because yeah, there's, you know, lots of self-exploration and meditation and all of those sorts of things that can be done, but ultimately the real points of tension and emotional charge and wounds, you know, relate to the mother, they relate to the father, and they can be reconciled as and when we truly commit to resolving those points of difference as and when they come up. And so I've only lived with my mother for about a year and a half after 20 years of not living together. And so that's been, you know, a spiritual journey in its own right, a really beautiful one for both of us, because it's moved a lot. And that's, you know, something I'll forever be grateful for, because it's been such a teacher.
Yeah, there's that saying is, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a weekend with your family.
Another Ram Dass one.
I believe it. Yeah, it is. It's true. You know, the connection with the mother can withstand many traumas, and is so ingrained and deep. And I also believe we have those universal beings that are kind of, I don't know, behind us, that are ageless, in our children and in our parents. And we all have something to learn from each other in that journey. The younger people trying all those different modalities to find and seek enlightenment, what I'm seeing is, and I was there before, I think it's normal, it's part of growing up, we want to get there quickly, you know, as we're younger. I'm going to see that in my sons, and I have young people, it's like, well, how did you get there? How do you do that? How do you do this? And sometimes you got to do the journey. You got to climb the mountains. You got to have the hardships. You got to have the falls. There's no shortcut. I mean, you can try to do some work that helps you move a little faster or see some things, but, sometimes I see those people who layer so many things on top of each other that they've forgotten what the baseline was. And it's like, oh, I've done Kembo, I've done Bufo, I'm trying all those vitamins at the same time. I'm trying, you know, and I'm like, do you even remember which way is out and where the light is in your journey here? Because that's a lot of energies to work with. And we need to give ourselves time to kind of go back to baseline. Also love that, you know, you called out. It's like, I don't necessarily do medicine anymore. You know, like you said that. And I think that's a big thing. Like for me is when I do medicine now, it's to be of service. So it's a different kind of phase, in the journey. But like, there's a point where You have a lot to integrate after a while, and it's going to take a lifetime. So even when you're a service, you get lessons.
Yeah, and that's the fun of it. Is it never stops. You know, the lessons just keep coming. It's such a blessing to walk the human path, and to just, for me, it's really about allowing. These days, and allowing the lessons to come and developing deeper energetic sensitivity to where people are at. If and when I am the right type of person to be of service to them. And so that's really an interesting exploration and evolution as well.
The allowing is beautiful. Recently it came to me as an unfoldment. And a lot of times we try to control things, how things unfold, and we're taught to control things to get to the end goal. And now I see it more as there's a big unfoldment of everything, and it's a beautiful unfoldment. And you know, all we can do is maybe nudge a little bit here, nudge a little bit there, but a lot of it is kind of flowing with it, learning how to flow with that unfoldment and respect it. There's so many beautiful messages from that work. And, you know, that's why we have those conversations. Another guest, it was Luc van Polge from Amsterdam. And he said, you know, like the psychedelics help us feel versus just knowing. And they help us see where we could go. And where we could be if we put in the work. And I love that distinction, which you talked about as well, of the knowing versus feeling. So I think with those podcasts and those interviews, I'm hoping people will get inspired to go experience and feel some of those things. And it doesn't have to be psychedelics. It could be breath work. It could be yoga, meditation. There's all those different modalities. But also take their times in their journey.
Yeah. Well said.
I want to bring it back. We're almost at time to leadership. And the question I ask everyone is, if you were to capture the essence of leadership into a plant, animal, or totem, what would it be? And I don't know if you remember your answer. I hope you do.
I do. I don't know if I remember all aspects of it, but I know I remembered answering with the jackal. And this one really struck me a few years ago when my father was still alive. We went on a family trip to Africa. Wow. on safari. And there's so many amazing animals to see on safari. But it was the jackal that always gave me this sense of joy because it was always just really on a mission. Its ears were always all the way up. It was just on the move, in the fray of all sorts of much larger animals, and just totally doing its own, you know, on its own very specific path. And I think, you know, I think in the Tao Te Ching, you know, there's something in there. I can't remember exactly the description, but there's something to the effect that, you know, each movement needs a leader. I think some of us have perhaps some optimistic views about holocratic governance models and those sorts of things, which I think, you know, absolutely they have their place. But, you know, when it comes to it, I think things require leadership. And if that's fractured, then it becomes a little bit more challenging in particular times. And I think it really depends upon the nature of the mission. And so, yeah, for me, the jackal just really embodied that, like that sense of like, there's a direction and I'm going there, and I don't need to, and I need to keep my ears up and listen and stay alert. But I don't need to take it too seriously either. This kind of this lighthearted, light-footed nature to the, to the pursuit.
Oh, beautiful. When you brought up Africa and animals and connected to the earth and nature and where you really see the rhythms of life, it kind of brought me to the movie Avatar, the new one. Have you seen it by any chance?
I haven't seen the new one. I've seen the old one.
It's very interesting. It's also a little bit controversial if you look at the reviews. and I've got my own opinion on it. But you know, I'll just wait for you to watch it, and then we can jam on the Avatar movie, and what you thought about it.
Sounds good. Well, I definitely have a view on avatars in a more general sense. I think these are amazing pieces of technology. I mean, forget ChatGPT. I think we're just at the very beginning of understanding the possibilities of humanities and the relationship between humanity and the quantum field. And so whether we talk about telekinesis or teleportation or any of these other things that we deem to be supernatural, I think as the collective consciousness begins to shift, and I think as more people really go far in their ability to manipulate energy with the best of intentions, or perhaps not so, that we will really begin to shift our imagination and the collective consciousness in terms of what's possible. And I think that's going to lead to this exponential rise that makes ChatGPT look a little bit silly, to be honest.
Yeah. No, agreed. Well, beautiful. Did you want to talk about anything else or ask me any questions before we depart on our own journeys and stay connected?
Yeah, I'd love to ask you a question about how do you see this this space unfolding from where you sit? Obviously, you know, I think Seattle is much more mature in relation to the space relative to where I am in Asia. So I'd just love your perspectives on how you see this work unfolding with time.
The space of AI in our lives or spiritual work?
Spiritual work.
I think it's going to take a while to properly unfold. I see... you talked about false light. It wasn't on the show, but it was beforehand. There's a lot of what you called false light here as well. I see... I'm trying not to judge. The hard thing is I'm trying not to judge too much, but I don't want to get stuck in that false light as well, but I see it. I see people going in there for the wrong reasons, scaling it. There's a lot of pressure to scale this. And as soon as you try to scale something, it becomes a little more sterile. And so how do you retain that warmth and that soul connection? I see it everywhere. There's this, the decriminalization versus the medical aspect. My personal perspective is I'm for decriminalization with safeties in place to support people and their experience and their growth, but that's going to take a while. It's a culture shift. And so, medical makes sense, but it becomes kind of an exclusive approach that, hey, if you don't have a condition, like you could have a new stigma. It's like, oh, wow, you went to do ayahuasca. Like, what's wrong with you? And so there's a lot at work. I feel it's going to take time. I'm excited about the space. But there's definitely a place for people who do what you're doing and people who do what I'm doing, which I think it goes not just for mental health, but elevating our consciousness and creativity. And that's just a huge part of our human journey. So that's kind of how I see the space. And I'm cautious. Mental use of psychedelics in the context that most people talk about, with like a therapist or at a clinic, is completely different from, a retreat where you have more warmth and more soul. And just like we said earlier, there's something for everyone, a ketamine clinic. It might be that somebody can only do a ketamine clinic or they're being called to it. But again, even with that, you have to be very careful because I had a guest on the show, Jason Levallee, who shared his ketamine experience, and it was terrible. Like there was no coaching on beforehand. He brought his own playlist, so he had no idea on how to work with music. So he had those psychedelic songs with lots of lyrics, but just because it's a psychedelic song doesn't mean that it's good for a psychedelic ceremony. So it took him to really dark places. Wow. you know, and then they learn from it. But like, you know, people have to be cautious, and he did, and he found other clinics afterward that were much better, and so on. So
glad to hear it.
Yeah,
we're in for an interesting ride. That's for sure.
Yeah. And you know, be patient. I mean, that's my thing, is like, it's going to take a while. And, you know, in the meantime, for people who are connected with the medicine and the work we talked about, is continue to do your work, be patient, and, you know, be here now. So
well said. Be here now.
So, yeah. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure, Sebastian. Thank you.
Yeah. How can people get connected with you? What's the best way?
Yeah, they can either check us out on behold-retreats.com, or we're just starting to become a little bit more active on social media again. We don't do much. I'm on LinkedIn, Jonathan DePotter. Anyone can always look me up. And we're on Instagram as well, @behold_retreats.
Great. And I do enjoy your posts on LinkedIn, so keep them coming. And thank you.
Yeah, I enjoy yours as well. Well, it's been a real pleasure, Sebastian. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts. Follow me on Instagram @leadershipadelics, or stop by my website and say hi at fouyad.com. That's FOOYAD. There's a lot going on. And I'd love to hear from you all, the listeners that tune in every week. And if you have suggestions for future guests, don't hesitate to reach out. I'm there, and I'd love to get more guests on the show. Thank you. Have a great day.